This is The Reason Podcast, and I'm your host, Nick Gillespie. Please subscribe to us at iTunes and rate and review us while you're there. Today, I'm talking with Bob Poole, Robert W. Poole Jr. He is the founding editor of Reason Magazine, who took over the publication just a few years after it was originally launched and served as the editor for a good chunk of time. And we're talking about Reason and our 50th anniversary. Bob has been with us longer than any single employee, and he knows where all the bodies are buried. And he knows where all the gold is stashed, too. Bob, thanks so much for joining the Reason Podcast.
Glad to be here, Nick.
So, you know, one of the things we're going to be doing is talking, to kind of flesh out a history of our first 50 years is talking with people like yourself about the early days of Reason, with a particular eye towards our journalism, where we were ahead of the curve, where Reason was prescient and was talking about things that are still either still in play, or where we had the right idea early on and we saw that come to fruition. And we'll also talk a little bit about places where we kind of muffed up. But, you know, I'm particularly excited to talk to you because you go all the way back to 1968. Can you talk a little bit about, how you first Reason was founded or created by a guy named Lanny Friedlander, who was a student in Boston in 1968. How did you come across Reason at the first point?
Well, I, as a young libertarian, having graduated from MIT and working in my first job at Sikorsky Aircraft, I was desperate for companionship, people who understood these ideas. And I discovered a little now defunct publication called Liberal Innovator that was published in Los Angeles, a libertarian thing. And it had a classified ad for Reason Magazine, and it sounded a little bit brandy in whatever it said in the ad. So I subscribed to it. It was like $2 for a subscription.
That would be about $200 now, right?
Right,
something,
right.
Given fiat currency and all that.
Yeah. So I actually started with issue number 3. Mimeographed, of course,
wow.
That ancient technology.
Yeah, no.
And it was, kind of sloppy looking in the mimeograph days, but Lanny wrote some trenchant prose and very scathing critiques of government boondoggles and things. And I thought, wow, this is pretty good. It's worth getting. And I did not meet Lanny until 1969. I had gotten in touch with him. We didn't have email in those days, but
right.
By letter and phone calls. And he invited me to write an article because he learned that I was an aerospace engineer and thought I could write something interesting. And I decided to write about why the government was essentially created a cartel of airlines. And flying was a luxury. Prices were very expensive.
Well, do this for a second. Set the scene, in the late 60s, early 70s. I mean, and I want you to do it in two ways. First, you said, you had these libertarian ideas, but it was a pretty lonely planet back then for
right.
libertarians. How did you come to libertarian ideas? And then also Reason, the name Reason betrays or belies,
yes,
rather,
yes.
Underscores the objectivist roots of the magazine, Lanny. And you are not, you're not doctrinaire objectivist, but you're very into the thoughts of Ayn Rand. And there was a big split going on within the objectivist movement.
I had in high school, I had a senior class for a limited number of students called Mathematical Analysis. The teacher, Daryl Johnson, was also the debate coach. And since we were kind of the college-bound kids, one day a month he gave us a lecture on political economy instead of math. Get away with it.
Yeah.
And he introduced ideas, like Milton Friedman and so forth. He was probably more of a limited government conservative, but it really intrigued me. I as a result of that, I read Barry Goldwater's Conscience of a Conservative and was excited by his vision of limited government and free markets. And I went off to MIT with a subscription to National Review because there wasn't any other magazine that he or I knew of that had these ideas, but also to The Freeman, published by the Foundation for Economic Education. And then at MIT, I got involved with Young Americans for Freedom and the MIT Students for Goldwater chapter that was created for the 64 election. Most of my fellow students in those groups were libertarians and or objectivists.
What
and they
was
were
the
astonished that I huh?
Well, what was the dividing line between conservatives and libertarians back then? And I realize the term libertarian was used, but probably
but
more
not
sparingly.
In not in widespread use.
Well, was it about social
conservatives
issues?
Conservatives were called traditionalists, trads.
I see.
Lord Acton was kind of their hero, whereas ours were people like Hayek and Friedman and von Mises. And so it turns out, again, that in the YAF chapter at MIT, most of the people were objectivists and or libertarians. Mm-hmm. And in palling around and having discussions with them, you've got to read Atlas Shrugged. You will love it. And so in the summer of 64, on a summer job, I carried a paperback book around, read it on lunch hours, read it in the evenings, and read the whole thing that summer. And I thought, wow, this really explains things a lot better than the arguments I was hearing from conservatives. I had also had courses at MIT, humanities courses at MIT, that introduced me to the ideas of the Enlightenment. So we actually read excerpts from Locke, Mill, Adam Smith, and others, and particularly reading the guy in I'm sorry, I'm blanking
no,
on his
no,
name.
Sure.
David Hume, wrote an essay debunking the idea of miracles, and that really got to me too. That coursework and those readings reinforced the ideas I was getting out of Rand.
So was one of the early points, and I realize, you know, like the libertarian movement now, thanks to, you know, I mean, we're all standing on your shoulders, in the libertarian movement, but it's so much broader now. But was a key distinction, not the only one or anything, but mm-hmm. that traditionalists or limited government conservatives at that time tended to be more interested in hierarchy and religion. It sounds like you guys were much more mathematical and kind of you didn't want to argue from authority as much as let's do the Enlightenment, you know, like get the Enlightenment stuff of not arguing
and
from authority.
I think it appealed to us engineering students in particular mm-hmm. because, you know, we were learning quantitative methods and how to think about, you know, what alternatives that are available gives you the best outcome. And it seemed pretty clear already and I had a course in the history of technology also, sort of learned about the Industrial Revolution. And it seemed very clear that Enlightenment ideas led to prosperity and more freedom and so forth, as opposed to hierarchy and religious, the union of church and state and all that sort of stuff. So it was very exciting times for me. Yeah. And I lost all that after graduating because I wasn't in a community of people like that.
Because then you're working at Sikorsky, which was based in Connecticut, right?
Southern Connecticut, right.
Yeah, and so then you're hanging out with a lot of engineers who are obviously they're good at math if they're, aircraft, but they're not necessarily
much interested in these ideas. So I really glommed on to reason. I took an evening course from the Nathaniel Brandon Institute mm-hmm. on taped lectures about objectivism. But the people weren't very friendly, and I didn't really make any friends in that. So I really got more interested in reason after Lanny invited me to write an article, which I did and became a cover story.
Now let's talk about the economic context, or not the economic context, really, the policy context. So, you know, we talked about kind of the sociological and mm-hmm. political. So you write a story about how, I remember, I'm 54, and I remember the last days of airline regulation in a way. But mostly grew up, like by the time I was in college, the People's Express blessedly come into play, a low cost airline where you could buy a ticket really cheaply at the, you know, et cetera. But, you know, this was a rigidly enforced cartel that people
really
can
and all
almost
kinds of, law firms made their living on arguing rate cases before the Civil Aeronautics Board, defending incumbents against new entrants and this sort of thing.
Yeah, and saying, well, the government, I mean, like, okay, you get to, if you're, Eastern Airlines, to pick one that doesn't exist anymore, you get to fly this route and you can charge this much. And I remember you saying at one point that even the food that was served on the airlines was kind of approved by the government at that point.
Well, and it also, I mean, the food was one of the few, food and drinks was one of the few things they could compete on. Price competition was strictly forbidden.
Wow.
And so this became a cost-plus kind of thing, and the labor union just loved it because they would negotiate very generous contracts, and then it would just get passed through by the CAB. Okay, that's your cost base, so of course the fares can go up to cover those costs. Eastern Airlines, I grew up in an Eastern Airlines household, so my family and I could fly for free on passes, so... You know, we were hardly anybody of my classmates had the experience of flying, which I started at age four.
Right, and then you would get like the I know I took at least one regulated flight on Braniff, to name another airline that no longer exists, and like you would get, you know, just because it was so expensive, they would give you like a little flight bag with a bunch of junk in it.
It was
It's stunning, really. And that world blessedly is gone. So what was your article was talking about how this is a cartel.
The motivation for the article actually stems back to my childhood and the CAB regulation. Eastern Airlines competed to get the route from Miami to Los Angeles and lost. My cousin Tom's father worked for National Airlines, which won. And so he and his family got to go to Disneyland on company passes. I never got to go to – we could never afford to send four people to California, to Los Angeles the prices that it would cost. So,
and then to drive would have taken, you know, two and a half weeks there and back.
So it was just not out of the question. So I headed in for the CAB starting from my childhood, and I didn't know anything about how it worked or anything other than that it seemed like a bad thing.
And, you know, so really reason starting in 1968 is, you know, obviously a lot of stuff is going on in 1968 and the wheels are coming off both in good and bad ways of the post-war consensus of, you know, this is what social society should look like. Integration was disappearing, but also the kind of regimentation of essentially a wartime economy where the government was getting to say, OK, you're going to make this much stuff and you're going to charge this much. So then you helped articulate the case for deregulating the airlines, mostly successful.
It only took 9 years after that for it to actually happen, which was very gratifying.
Yeah. No. So let's let's flash forward a little bit to some of the standout reason features that happened while you were editor in the 70s in particular, I guess, through the early 80s. You talk about there was a cover story that you wrote in May of 1976 called Fighting Fires for Profit. And that ended up getting featured on a 60 Minutes episode.
60 Minutes,
which is like obviously for a magazine like Reason, a small magazine, a political magazine, to get that kind of coverage. And 60 Minutes must have been watched by like, you know, 80% of Americans. But what was the point of that story and why was it ahead of its time?
Yeah, the point of that story was to show that practically every service provided by a city government could be purchased from the private sector if conditions were open and if there were incentives for people to start companies providing them. You know, there was a fair amount in the 70s of contracted garbage service. That was one of the most common. And I started getting really interested in that because of my work when I moved to California in 1970, started working for a think tank that was working with state and local governments on implementing mini computer systems for things like police and fire dispatching. And on one of my early jobs, I was in Phoenix, Arizona. It was the company, the city we were dealing with. But Rural Metro Fire, which was the focus of my Reason article, was providing the fire service in Scottsdale, the suburb of Phoenix, on a contract basis. And it had been written about in the LA Times and elsewhere. It cost about a third as much as the fire service in Phoenix. And this is incredible. How on earth are they doing that? And so while I was on location in Phoenix, out of the blue, I just called up the Rural Metro and talked to the CEO, Louis Weitzman, and told him who I was and asked if I could come and visit. And he was very gracious, allowed me to do that, gave me a tour, and I learned all the things that they did differently from conventional city fire departments that enabled it to be much less, you know, fire departments, very labor-intensive business. So they implemented a system that was partly like volunteer fire departments. Mm-hmm. They had a core staff of full-time paid people, but they had trained volunteers who mostly worked for the city government and had permission when a fire alarm call came in that they would have a beeper and be notified, drop what they were doing, and report to their assigned fire station and go to the fire if necessary. And that dramatically lowered the cost. They also had technology innovations and things that people had not seen in fire departments before.
And so this was your kind of the beginning of your bromance with privatization, a term that you helped to popularize.
Yes, it was,
but
which eventually
the idea
led to
go ahead.
Eventually led to my book, Cutting Back City Hall, that came out in 1980, which was the first book to really talk about and seriously research and write about how governments could buy services instead of producing them all as monopoly services.
Wow, and this is something, I mean, on a certain level, this isn't exactly, it's not the sexiest topic in the world, perhaps, but it's absolutely fundamental and important. And I actually kind of do find it sexy in the sense of we're living in that world now where, obviously municipal governments have continued to grow in many ways and or state and local county federal governments. But, they do have to explain why they're not contracting out services.
Exactly. It's become quite accepted as a mainstream technique. It's much harder to do in big old cities like Chicago and New York, where unions are very powerful. And the traditions of politicians being basically partners with unions and high-cost city monopoly services, it's hard to crack. But competitive contracting really got going in the Southwest and Sunbelt areas, and then gradually moved into the Midwest and the Northeast as well.
So another story that you talked about, that you had a hand in July of 1978, it was called Rockets in Africa. And it had to do with something, again, this is hilarious to think about it now, because and 1978 is what? That's like the era of Skylab. We've essentially given up on, kind of manned space exploration, but there's these kind of weird, artifacts of the 1960s kind of Kennedy era space program floating around. But it's about private space launch companies.
Yeah, it's what we today call new space.
Yeah.
A German company called OTRAG came up with the idea of modular components to make very low cost rocket launchers for launching satellites. And I had been reading articles about this in Aviation Week and in Popular Science, and I thought, wow, this could be the breakthrough that we need to revitalize the space industry, have it not be dominated by cost-plus government contracts. And then all of a sudden, Penthouse magazine in December 1977 had what they called an expose, that OTRAG was really producing cruise missiles, and testing them in violation of this and that and the other thing. And it was just unbelievable, the contrast between what Aviation Week had been reporting, and they're very, very good on these things, Popular Science, so forth. So I thought, there's something really wrong here. So I did a lot of, I don't know how I had the time, but did a lot of research, and finally discovered that the author, who was a kind of lefty journalist, had been taken in by East German propaganda that had depicted this as an evil thing. The article had had some traction in France because the French and British governments were developing a space launch equivalent of NASA, a government enterprise.
Right.
And they very much feared low-cost competition from the private sector.
Which, of course, is now where all of the energy space exploration and exploitation in the most positive terms possible is coming from.
No, absolutely. So that cover story was the first non-techie magazine to really write about what we call now new space or private space launch. And fascinating thing was, as I was writing my memoir that's going to come out later this year, and recounting writing that story, I get an email from a video journalist, documentary producer in Germany, doing a film about OTRAG.
Oh, that's great.
The company, you know, went bankrupt because after the attacks and so forth, and didn't. But Lutz Kaiser, the founder and CEO of that at the time, is still alive, and they were interviewing him. They found my Reason story. I thought, and the guy interviewed me at length by email. How on earth had I figured this out and not been taken in by the Penthouse story and blah 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 blah. And so they may end up coming when they do the last part of it, coming and interviewing me on camera here.
As a sidebar on that a little bit, you know, obviously Ayn Rand and her thought and her fiction was very important to the libertarian movement in you know, in post-war America up through at least through the 70s or early 80s. Robert Heinlein is also, you know, I've met a lot of people who come to libertarianism through Robert Heinlein. Obviously, a prophet of space exploration and terraforming Mars and all of this kind of stuff, or projecting humanity.
But also space. Very much an individualist and a critic of government and so forth.
Talk about how did Robert Heinlein shape your kind of vision?
Oh, well, I grew up reading. Heinlein wrote a series of what are called juvenile novels, actually young adult, really.
Right.
And some of the stories that make up those books were originally published in Boy's Life, the Boy Scout magazine. And I read them all starting in elementary school and read most of the rest in junior high. And I'm sure that gave me, you know, more receptivity as I started discovering ideas about politics and political economy and economics and so forth. And one of the amazing blessings or benefits from doing Reason Magazine was in the 1970s, getting on Robert Heinlein's Christmas card list and learning from then corresponding with his wife, Ginny, who handled all his correspondence, that they loved Reason Magazine and said that if you're ever in Santa Cruz, why don't you let us know and stop by for a visit? Oh my God!
Yeah,
died and gone to heaven. So, needless to say, arranged a trip up to the Bay Area, south of the Bay Area, and went for an afternoon visit, swim tour of the house that they personally designed. You know, Heinlein being an engineer. And ended up getting invited for dinner, and in case something like that had happened, I had a box of Heinlein first editions that I had been accumulating in the car as I went out and got them, and he autographed a bunch of them and asked if I read any foreign languages. I said, well, I had 3 years of German. He says, would you like a few German paperbacks? And I said, sure, I still have those too. But it was just an amazing, wonderful experience. He reminisced about having been at the Apollo, you know, the one that first landed on the moon, I guess, Apollo 11, I guess it was. You know, having been NASA's guest of honor there and so on and so forth. I think when I watch SpaceX launches today, particularly the Falcon Heavy launch a few weeks ago, Robert Heinlein, you should be alive at this time to see the world that you gave us the vision of starting to finally happen after all these years.
Yeah, it's, you know, and it's fascinating to think about somebody like Heinlein and somebody like Rand, who, you know, both wrote essays, but also are probably best remembered or had the biggest impact in their fiction. And Heinlein's Stranger in a Strange Land is, you know, a novel at the beginning of the 60s, before the, you know, the kind of 60s counterculture it started, but it's, you know, it's essentially about exploration in space, and then a lawyer kind of arguing due process claims back on Earth to make, you know, to protect the ultimate immigrant. And he's simultaneously a tech guy and a hippie. I mean, you can see so much coming out of there. And the same with Rand. You know, one of the things that's Rand ultimately now is heavily, very, very much, mostly for understandable reasons, identified with the right. But when you go back and you read histories of the 60s, I mean, these two people were really background thinkers for almost everybody.
If you look at Rand, although people can criticize various aspects of her characters, she portrayed strong women in the business world in a way that was completely unheard of in the 1950s.
Yeah.
And people, a lot of people tend to forget that sort of thing. And she also projected sexual freedom of a kind that was completely alien to at least polite conversation in the
60s. As did, of course, Heinlein as well. I find it that these guys were talking, and this is another way in which their work, and I think the libertarian movement and reason, you know, remains fresh, is that, you know, it's the individual versus the collective, and that can be big government or big business or, you know, whatever, or, you know, and I mean, it's a powerful motif. Here, let's talk about the Love Canal story, which came out in February of 1981 and was covered by ABC Nightline, which had turned after the, I guess, after the successful conclusion of the Iranian hostage crisis. Nightline became, it was a staple of 80s TV. It was the must-watch show every night. But what was the Love Canal story? I want to give background to people who don't know. If you grew up in the 70s and the early 80s, you know, everybody was convinced, or, you know, the general news media, that the world was being polluted beyond belief and that we were giving rise to, you know, children who were born with deformities and everybody was having these bizarre cancers. And Love Canal became kind of a shorthand like Three Mile Island or Chernobyl or thalidomide. I mean, it was a locus of so much anxiety and fear.
Right. And the mainstream narrative was that Hooker Chemical, evil by definition as a chemical company, had recklessly dumped chemical wastes and allowed them to seep out through the surrounding residential neighborhood and cause potential major harm to people who live there. Well,
Niagara Falls, New York.
Niagara Falls, New York.
You know, one of the archetypal Rust Belt cities.
And
so it's like everything has gone to shit, really. I went to grad school in Buffalo and would drive to Niagara Falls all the time and go through the Love Canal.
Area.
Yeah. And I mean, in the early 80s, it was reeling. So.
Well, this was now in the beginning days of Reason Foundation, and we had published one investigative journalism article that exposed some illegal use of federal grants by Cesar Chavez's farm workers union, and that actually got some TV coverage as well. But on the strength of that, we had started raised some money to make investigative journalism one of the main an important thing that we were doing to raise Reason's credibility and visibility and so forth. So over the transom, as we say, we got a proposal from this freelance journalist named Eric Zeus, who said the mainstream narrative of Love Canal is completely wrong, and I can prove it. And he gave us some reasons of what he felt he had, and we decided it looked like he had a decent case, and if he could really document it, we gave him the go-ahead. And he really, he did his homework. He discovered that the real story was that Hooker Chemical had, in the days when it dumped those wastes,
and that's what the Love Canal was, like the dumping ground. It was the
dumping
kind
ground,
of
exactly,
the chemical estuary of,
because
you know, Bob, we're talking about it because we lived through it, like Love Canal. You know, like if you say, hey, you know, baby, Love Canal, people think, so, you know, if they don't know the history, they think, it's a canal of love or something. You know, but, so he found that.
At any rate, they had followed what were then the established procedures. They put a clay cap over the top and so forth. And at some point in the, I think in the early 70s, I can't remember the details, the local school board wanted to use eminent domain to condemn the property that included Love Canal so they could build a new school. And Hooker Chemical resisted, and this is documented, they resisted. Yep. They said, you know, we buried chemical waste there. You should not buy the property.
They were showing up at meetings to say, like, look, you can't put a school there. I mean, it's on top of, like, toxic chemicals.
And so they eventually were unable to prevent the condemnation of the property, and they insisted on including a deed restriction saying that disclosing the chemicals such were buried there, do not interfere in any way, don't breach the clay that's underneath and on the sides and on the top, because you will let chemicals leak out. Well, the school board after a few years after buying it, decided they really need to go ahead and build the school. They excavated and built the school, and the excavation led to the chemicals leaching out. So, and all of this he documented meticulously, Eric Zeus did, and we had learned on the first article on the Cesar Chavez thing about how to fact check, and we spent, you know, Marty Zupan and I spent many days fact checking every detail of this, and there probably were a few little minor points that, that he hadn't quite documented. So, you know, we obviously edited it to things that we knew we could stand behind. And we had a woman in Washington, D.C., a freelance media consultant who had helped us publicize the Cesar Chavez article, and she did the same with this, and that led to a bunch of news coverage. Larry King did radio programs on it. Syndicated columnists wrote about it, and that that's what led, I'm sure it was, to ABC Nightline discovering it, checking it out, and then interviewing Eric Zeus. Eric Zeus of Reason Magazine on camera, standing in front of Love Canal houses. It was a great. It was just one of those things that you live and breathe to have those kinds of successes.
The you know, that story also helps. I mean, along with earlier stories, some of which we've discussed here. But you know, it's also that the DNA of Reason is that, you know, where you take a mainstream media narrative or government narrative that is saying, look, there are clear heroes and villains here and we know who's who. And really you start to dig in and you realize, you know, that oftentimes it's almost the exact reverse. And it's based on that, you know, meticulous attention to detail and to go in with a different framework so that you're coming out with something much more like the truth.
And it's very satisfying to do those kind of articles.
Sure. So, well, let's talk about some We've Made It moments, you know, over the course of your era as editor of Reason, because you're now a transportation policy analyst for Reason Foundation. So you're doing more of that. But you were asked by the Reagan White House to brief the Secretary of Transportation and the Federal Aviation Administrator, Agency Administrator, on air traffic control. You know, what was going on there? Because this, again, set the scene. I mean, what was going on in 1981 with air traffic control?
Right, 1981, the Controllers Union, PATCO, with F. Lee Bailey, I think, as its legal guy, called an illegal strike. It was against the law for air traffic controllers to strike. And this was a first big challenge posed to the Reagan administration. What would they do about this? And Reagan ordered them back to work within 48 hours on penalty of being fired if they didn't. A handful of them came back and the rest stayed out. They were fired. Nothing. It was an earthquake. It was a shot across the bow of the whole labor union movement. But it meant that the air traffic control system was hugely short of people. You know, you can't operate without air traffic controllers. And so airlines were ordered to cut way back on their scheduled flights because they had supervisors who were not part of the union. And a portion of the people had not gone out at all, defying the union. But it was a real crisis situation of what are we going to do to rebuild the air traffic control system? Well, it turned out that a whole bunch of people who had written for Reason or were friends of Reason Foundation had gotten jobs in the early Reagan administration. One of them was my longtime friend John McClory from Vermont, and he was in the office of domestic policy office of the White House, and he saw an op-ed that I wrote in the New York Times, maybe it's time to dismiss the FAA, in August of that year, shortly after the firing, which was on early August. And I suggested that it should be a nonprofit corporation paid for by the users, ideas that we hear about a lot today. And so John circulated the op-ed, and he probably also circulated a Reason cover story from 1979 that I had written about how bad the FAA was and why it wasn't really the right institution to have. And John got enough interest that in those two things that he called me and said, I need you in Washington tomorrow.
Yeah.
So I managed to get a flight, and actually he gave me a desk in a vacant office and said, you've got today to come up with a briefing for the DOT Secretary, Drew Lewis, and the FAA Administrator, Lynn Helms, on why this should be privatized right. as the way to rebuild it.
And now, of course, you've been pushing that kind of corporate nonprofit, which has taken off around the world. I mean, Canada has a system that essentially the system you were proposing in other countries.
And Canada's was implemented 22 years ago.
Yeah, so
proved the test of time.
Yeah, and we're actually, I mean, to talk about prescience, this is a place where you've been making this case, and are we getting closer to actually implementing something like that where, you know, the airlines are the ones who need the system the most, and they're in the best position both to fund it and innovate, et cetera. Are we getting closer to that moment?
We're getting much closer. This is something, since I became really focused on transportation policy, I've published about a dozen policy papers on this over the years. I've joined the Air Traffic Control Association. I speak at conferences. I have since 2000 or 2001, I do a monthly newsletter all those years on air traffic control reform, basically trying to break down the old paradigm that this is something only government should do, and that you get the best safety by having the safety regulators and the providers all in the same house working cooperatively, and instead of at arm's length from each other, so that the safety regulators properly ride herd on the controllers, just as they ride herd on the airlines and the manufacturers, et cetera, et cetera. So it took a long time to break down the old paradigm, but that has pretty much happened worldwide in the last, since 1987. So that's for 30 years it's been processed from New Zealand. It's labor reform government in 1987. Creating an air traffic control corporation separate from the safety regulator in New Zealand. That actually became the model for the Clinton White House in the early 90s.
You talked to them about this, right?
Called me and asked my advice and input, and I testified in Congress guardedly in favor of their proposal, which ended up getting nowhere due to status quo opposition. The idea now, we are now to the point, we have 60 of these corporations in operation. We have a global trade association of air navigation service providers called CANSO that holds big annual conferences and is a player in international aviation policy. And we have the model, very much the model I proposed of a nonprofit corporation. 22 years success in Canada as significantly more efficient than the FAA system, even though the FAA should have economies of scale from being almost 10 times larger. Nav Canada has won international awards as the world's best air traffic provider. The airlines in the United States are totally on board, 100% for a corporation along these lines. We had legislation last year passed the House Transportation Committee, but got no further.
What's the holdup?
The holdup has been the private pilots groups and the business jet people who pay practically nothing and getting first-class services. And they have huge lobbying clout. They give lots of campaign contributions.
And I'm sure they give lots of rides, right, to congressmen.
So they have managed to create a false narrative that this would be handing over a valuable enterprise to the control of the big airlines, which is ridiculous since the big airlines would appoint one seat on a 13-member board of stakeholders to be the governing body. But it's a campaign of lies, and they terrorized, frightened the hell out of city leaders, mayors in small cities, small town America.
You're not going to get any.
You're not going to have a control tower anymore. Yeah. They're going to spend all the money on better air traffic at big airports where the big airlines fly and all this sort of stuff. And that has proved pretty politically powerful. There is no, because the rural states are have much higher, much stronger representation in the Senate. There's currently no Senate counterpart of the House bill.
Well, and with air traffic in general, I guess, or with air traffic policy, this has been the problem, is that the airline the ticket prices were deregulated, routing was deregulated mostly, but this and also airports, airport ownership and management.
In the state-owned model that was okay, was tolerable when the airline industry was not dynamic and fast-growing. Right. But, you know, we have 40 years since airline deregulation, a very dynamic and fast-changing airline market. that is constrained by badly managed airports that don't use runway pricing, for example, and by an air traffic system that
is still stuck with old technology. When you go to Europe or pretty much anywhere else in the world and you see airports that are like the greatest, you know, I mean, they're like shopping, you know, great shopping malls mixed with theme parks. Yeah, and they're all
Heathrow, Gatwick, Frankfurt, they're all privatized. Madrid.
Yeah, Schiphol.
That's been around the world for the last 20 years. Well, since Margaret Thatcher privatized the British Airports Authority in 1987, the same year as the first Air Traffic Control Corporation, coincidentally, you know, aviation has been transformed, and the United States is the last holdout.
Well, hopefully we'll get there. Let's talk briefly about something that you got wrong, because you know where you know Reason. Ultimately, I mean, for me, part of the allure of Reason as a magazine, but also libertarianism as a kind of worldview, is that it, you know, it's about, in many ways, it's about epistemological humility and the limits of knowledge. But you talked, you know, the private for-profit fire service was not necessarily quite the wave of the future, even though it did.
Right.
It folds into privatizing and contracting out and competitive contracting. But then you talked, here's an interesting thing, that there was a Howard Hughes mystery ship.
Yes.
that was it about seabed mining or about CIA efforts to recover a Soviet submarine?
Well,
what was that
story? Which I completely swallowed because I had written a recent article arguing against the Law of the Sea Treaty, which is a typical UN status central planning thing.
The Law of the Sea is basically that it gave the UN kind of adjudication rights over competing claims, or what?
More than that, it actually created on paper something called the Enterprise, which was to have control over all seabed mining. And so any companies that and we thought in the 70s that manganese nodules and other minerals on the seabed were going to be a cornucopia of new wealth. So the IDUN quickly jumped in and say, well, all right, we will license who can get the mine, but we're going to tax the proceeds and distribute it to third world developing countries. And so that was a significant obstacle to the entrepreneurial companies that thought they were going to make a big deal out of seabed mining. And but it looked as if, to me and everyone else, that when Howard Hughes produced a ship called the Glomar Explorer with all kinds of expensive gear on it and had it out in the ocean, that he was going to be the pioneer despite the UN Law of the Sea Treaty nonsense and so forth. And I think we had a recent article with a photograph of that ship talking about the potential of seabed mining and how this was going to, in effect, defy the UN, despite the UN attempt to do all this stuff. And about a year after that article appeared in Reason, it was exposed as a CIA exploit to try to recover a sunken Soviet submarine. And I think they only ever recovered, they did recover part of it, but they weren't able to get the whole thing. So they may or may not have learned a bunch of things from it. We don't know, because I don't think it's ever been declassified.
It's amazing you know, when you go back, and there's been new interest in what the CIA, the FBI, the NSA were up to in the post-war era. And of course, in the 1970s, you had things like the Rockefeller Commission and the Church Commission, which exposed massive systemic, you know, just completely unrestrained domestic spying by the FBI and COINTELPRO, but also the CIA and the NSA. And, you know, the CIA was dosing its own people with LSD for mind control. Do you feel like, I mean, this, and it's an interesting thing, because in libertarianism, and particularly in your tenure at Reason, you know, you were very much of a cold warrior. The Soviet Union was not morally equivalent. Like, it needed to be defeated. And in order to do that, you need a robust intelligence operation. But then how do you restrain?
Yes, I know. It's a tough challenge.
We are reliving that now, in
certain respects.
Yeah.
No, one of the other big investigative journalism projects we developed was sending Jack Wheeler, a noted adventure travel guy, to go with the various anti-Soviet guerrilla groups in five or six countries. And we got some kind of an award for that series And it was controversial. I think the sort of Murray Rothbard type libertarians didn't really think having a strong anti-Soviet policy was the right thing for the United States to do, and were not happy with reason for doing that. But I felt very justified in the Soviet Union was a clear and present danger. Obviously, the government can go overboard in particularly in domestic spying and things like that. But I think the cause was just one of the early books that I commissioned and edited that Reason Foundation published was called Defending a Free Society. And it had chapters on various aspects of defense policy in an era when you had a major threat such as the Soviet Union. Nothing like that had come out from the libertarian movement at all. And philosopher Eric Mack had probably the first chapter of the book, as I recall, explaining just war theory as it had been developed by philosophers over the centuries, and saying that it still should be valid. You have to use reason and careful thinking to determine is a cause just in the beginning to begin with to engage militarily, and obviously there should be real serious criteria for deciding that, and then second, how do you carry it out in a just fashion? And he actually drew out some implications that other contributors later on took up about strategy of using nuclear weapons and so forth. And we argued in the book that mutually assured destruction was very difficult to justify morally because you're basically threatening to annihilate huge amounts of population who they themselves were not guilty parties. And that was the principal tool of, and so therefore we supported a shift from MAD to strategic defense, missile interception and this sort of thing, to the point where it would be strong enough, which is obviously a matter of technology, and we aren't, I don't think we're still quite there, strong enough to deter a first strike attack. And this became a very big debating point among libertarians around the country.
Well, that notion of defending a free society, I mean, and again, this is something with the passage of time. I mean, it is hard to recapture the moment when the Soviet Union, what Reagan briefly characterized as an evil empire was, and then walked back, even Reagan walked that back, but... how much there, I mean, it was a real struggle. For all we talk about China or radical Islam or Russia under Putin, it's a totally different.
Those things all pale by comparison to the threat that the Soviet Union appeared to pose. Having guerrilla movements and taking over more countries to be allies and in effect colonies. It was really an amazingly threatening and serious thing, and we all grew up in the shadow of nuclear annihilation and so forth. So the collapse of the tearing down of the Berlin Wall and the collapse of the Soviet Union were just amazing, exhilarating events that never thought I would live to see.
Yeah, it's amazing, and I remember both of those. And I know that in the early days, when I joined Reason 20-something years ago, you often, at a speech, you have a chunk of the Berlin Wall that you would hold up. And it's stunning, and I get some of that sense, when we talk about the legalization of marijuana, but more importantly, the end of a prohibitionary regime that, affects every aspect of American life. But
And drug prohibition is something we took on from the very earliest.
Right. Yeah.
There's never any dissent or disagreement among the original editors that was a just cause.
This is what is also kind of now that libertarianism has achieved a certain level of ubiquity or, people are familiarity, I guess. It's hard to, if you go back and look at the early 70s reason where, you know, we're talking about drug legalization, we're talking about legalization of not just of homosexuality, but of recognition of same-sex marriages.
Yes,
A
we
lifestyle.
Way ahead of most of the country on those issues.
Yeah. So let me, to end, let's talk a little bit about, I've heard you talk about this in the past, but in the October 1971 issue, this was like an early milestone for Reason, because you scored an interview with Nathaniel Brandon, who had been protege of Ayn Rand and the kind of business and philosophical partner of Ayn Rand. They had had a big break, a breakup, but the causes of that later became known, but not for really for decades,
not for many years. But it caused, the main organization that was helping the broad libertarian movement to grow, certainly the objectivist part of it, was called the Nathaniel Brandon Institute, that he had organized with Ayn Rand's blessing to sell books, to promote the ideas, so forth and so on. And when Rand denounced Brandon in 1968 without giving any specifics, but just saying he'd done reprehensible things and she was breaking all association with him, NBI closed down. And there, all of a sudden, this widespread thing with doing classes all across the country, all of a sudden was no more.
And at the time, were you like, when you hear like Ayn Rand, excommunicates Nathaniel Brandon?
Yes,
but she doesn't say, all she says is he did reprehensible things. He was a moral leper and all of this. Like, what did you think though? Were you like, did he steal money? Did he commit a crime?
My then wife, Lynn Kinsky, who was an early partner in Reason Enterprises, said, which read Ayn Rand's, explanation announcement in the Objectivist magazine, said, "This sounds to me like a woman scorned," and she was right on target. She had psyched it out but nobody really knew, and there was a lot of speculation and so forth. So
at that point, just to kind of put a button on that, Rand and Brandon were in an intimate relationship that he broke off.
They had been right,
but nobody knew, right?
I mean, nobody knew. That's right, and so there was intense wondering and speculation, and so Tibor and I had met Nathaniel Brandon after we started up Reason Enterprises in 1971, and he had the mailing list, the old NBI mailing list, and he was starting to think about making it available for friendly groups to rent, to market to those people. And we wanted to, our plan for expanding the circulation of Reason Magazine, which when he got it from Lanny, it had 400 subscribers, was to find mailing lists. And that was our number one target. So we talked a lot with Nathaniel about that. He finally agreed. That he said, but I would like to give you guys an interview in Reason. And we thought, this will be a bombshell.
Yeah.
So we arranged a date and did the interview. There were five or six of us there, but we had a lead interviewer who asked almost all the questions. And we transcribed it. But Nathaniel's condition was that he get to review the transcript.
Uh-oh.
None of us had any journalism training.
Right.
We didn't really know how these things were done. And it turns out, instead of just correcting errors, he basically rewrote his answers. And what do we do? He didn't really explain about the affair, but he gave some clues and he talked about a lot of things. It was very, still very, very interesting, and it was the first time he'd said anything in print since the break 3 years before. So we went ahead and published it. And on the strength of that interview, when we did mailings to his mailing list, it was huge. We ended up about a year after starting for 400, we were over 3,500 or 4,000 subscribers.
Well,
without that, it's hard to know whether there would be a Reason today.
You know, one of the things that thinking about Brandon, you know, who at the time was a kind of leading apostle of the human potential movement.
Yes, right.
And you know, and was, you know, and again, all, you know, there, obviously there are all kinds of divisions and subdivisions and internecine warfare among all these groups. But he was, you know, a really interesting figure in all sorts of ways. What do you make of, you know, we tend to think about the libertarian movement has been dominated by economists and to a certain degree, engineers or people with a kind of engineering mindset. But then there are people, you know, and Rand in a certain way fits into this, but certainly people like Brandon, where there were psychologists who were talking about, you know, human.
Peter Bregan also.
Thomas Saws. You know, is that a somewhat neglected kind of tributary?
I think you're right, Nick. There's something there that people haven't really focused very much on. But, I mean, this is consistent in a way with the sort of Enlightenment roots of today's libertarianism, that it's about more than just economics and politics. It really is. It's about human flourishing and what are the conditions for human beings to have satisfying, flourishing lives. You know, Charles Murray wrote a nice book about this. And so again, there's a sociologist, not an economist or engineer.
Yeah, and then people like Sharon Presley in the early libertarian movement but of you know, what is the psychology of freedom? The you know, what kind of psychology do individuals need to have in order to be able to flourish in a society where they're given more opportunities and more choices to define themselves. It's and Brandon, I mean, looking back at that interview, of course, it's difficult now not to read it through the filter that, you know, romantic entanglement.
What we know now,
It's, yeah, he remains a fascinating character. And it's not surprising that, I mean, when you say, like, in a lot of ways, we might not have a reason if it wasn't for him, it makes sense that it was about a psychologist who, and a therapist who talked a lot about becoming the best version of yourself. Well, we will leave it there, Bob. I want to thank you so much. We have been talking with Robert W. Poole Jr. He's an early founding editor of Reason Magazine and everything that has come since then, as Reason is celebrating its 50th year. Bob, just a complete delight to reminisce with you about the early days and some of the early triumphs and also some of the early misses of Reason.
Thanks so much, Nick. It was great fun to do this.
This has been the Reason Podcast. I'm your host, Nick Gillespie. Thanks so much for listening. Please subscribe to us at iTunes and rate and review us while you're there.